The first case for argument this morning is the United States versus Eberhardt. Mr. Bachu.
May it please the court. A jury of the defendant's peers convicted him of conspiring with Charles Bolden and others of distributing quantities of cocaine. The district court overturned the jury's verdict based upon the cumulative effects of three events. It's significant in this case that the judge was unable to determine or unable to hold that any one of those three events constituted error. Before getting to the merits of the dispute, though, there's a threshold problem in this case, and that's a jurisdictional issue. As to those three events that issues that the judge found merited relief for the defendant, the judge was presented with those arguments for the first time in a supplement to a new trial motion, which was filed 5 months or so after the time for filing new trial motions. That means that under this court's decisions in Washington and Holt, the untimely materials could not be considered, and it was beyond the court's jurisdiction to actually grant relief based on the grounds forwarded for the first time in those materials. We think that would dispose of the main case in its whole and totality.
What would the government have done if the judge simply said, in response to the motion for new trial, no, I won't give you a new trial, but I've reconsidered the matter and I think the government failed in its proof and I find him not guilty?
At the time that the government...
No. Now, what would the government's position be had he done that?
If the trial court had found that there was insufficient evidence to sustain the conviction, then this case would be over.
Mm.
But that's not what happened.
I know it's not what happened. I was just curious as to whether he recognized he could have done that without turning the hair.
Certainly after a conviction has been entered by the jury and a judge decides upon a motion of the defendant that the evidence was insufficient, then the case would be over. But that's, as I said, not what happened here. What happened was that the judge denied the motion for judgment of acquittal, but granted the new trial motion based on untimely arguments advanced for the first time in the supplement. There were two of the arguments that are untimely. There was one that was referred to in the initial new trial motion. That is an argument relating to the accuracy of the transcripts at trial. That argument was actually expanded upon in the supplement as well. So in essence, the totality of the district court's order granting relief was based on the untimely arguments forwarded by the defendant. The defendant in his brief has suggested that we didn't raise this issue below, and our response to that is that while there is a suggestion we didn't raise it below, the defendant does not affirmatively say in his brief that we forfeited the argument by failure to raise it below. As such, the defendant has actually waived the claim or forfeited the claim of forfeiture itself, and this court may therefore consider our claim. And to the extent that there is actually a claim of forfeiture that has been properly raised by the defendant, our contention is that the point cannot be forfeited because it is a jurisdictional issue. It implicates the subject matter jurisdiction of the district court. And to the extent there is a recent decision from the Supreme Court, the contract decision, which deals with whether or not time limits are jurisdictional, our presentation in the papers is that that decision does not overrule prior decisions of the United States Supreme Court, including the Robinson decision, in which the Supreme Court indicated that a failure to abide by the time limits in Rule 45 led to a jurisdictional defect.
Mr. Roger, what about the argument that, or the ground relied on that are not affected by the supplement? The one ground that is not.
The one ground was the accuracy of the transcript.
Exactly.
The significance is that the district court said that the reason it was granting relief was because of the cumulative effect of the three errors. And it said that, you know, one of these issues standing alone or two of them in combination would not have been sufficient for the district court to grant a new trial.
So we shouldn't send this back and find out what impact, because it's only one can stand and it's you got to get two out of three here. It's like a tennis match.
No, Your Honor, I think for a couple of reasons. One, the district court was abundantly clear that it was the combined effect of the three errors that led it to decide as it did. As to the error relating to the purported error relating to the inaccuracy of the transcripts, it's also important to note that the issue was actually expanded in the supplemental filing. in the supplemental filing.
Well, that poison the jurisdiction.
I think it does because...
You think the jurisdiction now, like a toxic waste, seeps into the ground that he did rely on?
I think it does, and the reason is because the argument that was advanced in the supplement was that the tape had been annualized by forensic tape services, and that the analysis of that tape had resulted in the conclusion that a phrase in the tape, which had been translated or transcribed as saying, well, there's an exchange between Eberhardt and the defendant, Bolden. And during that exchange, Eberhardt is transcribed as saying that he wants to meet Bolden face-to-face. The tape that was introduced by way of the supplement, or the evidence introduced by way of the supplement, was that the phrase face-to-face cannot be found on the tape, that the syllables or the words really just don't make out that phrase. So that, it seems to me, if one looks at the judge's order, was what actually animated the judge's decision. He notes that there's some new evidence that's come to light, that, and I think he indicated he was troubled by that new evidence. But that new evidence wasn't new evidence. It was something that the defendant quite easily could have presented during the course of the case. And it's just, it's a situation where actually new defense counsel came on board after the trial was over.
But is it the government's position then that even assuming arguendo that jurisdiction doesn't attend the transcript argument, that it, by the judge's own words, that as a standalone, in effect, would be harmless error or just not enough to sustain the new trial?
That's correct. And I think it's also correct to say that this court's jurisdiction really extends only to the scope of determining whether or not to the extent the district court did not have jurisdiction, determining its lack of jurisdiction. It can't really reach the merits thereafter. And I think that point suggested by the Supreme Court's Steel Company case, not cited in our brief, but that's the case, as Your Honors will recall, where the Supreme Court rejected the idea of hypothetical jurisdiction. And in the course of doing so, it noted that, well, when an appellate court is faced with the issue of whether or not a district court has jurisdiction, its jurisdiction is limited to that question, not to actually going back to the merits and saying, well, is it possible that the judge would have granted relief on a sole issue or an independent issue than the one that was relief was granted upon. So I do believe that...
What do you think is the strongest untainted evidence of Eberhardt's guilt?
Probably his confession, Your Honor. His confession was quite descriptive. What we have with his confession is an admission from Mr. Eberhardt that he'd been engaging in cocaine trafficking for the period of about a year, that he'd been trafficking in quantities of 20 to 40 kilograms a month, that he had a supplier by the name of Tommy, that his supplier fronted him drugs, that he owed Tommy $70,000, that he supplied drugs to Charles Bolden, that there is some suggestion from that's not in the confession, but corroborates the confession that a debt was owed by Charles Bolden. This is the strongest evidence, and that evidence is corroborated by the fact that the defendant agreed to make calls to his source of supply, Tommy. And during the course of those calls, again, some of the statements that the defendant makes are corroborated. The defendant suggested that there was a regularized pattern of him obtaining drugs from Tommy, that he'd either obtain the drugs at 6 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock at night. And if one listens or reads the transcript of the recorded conversation between the defendant and Tommy, one finds out that Tommy suggests that they meet at 6 o'clock. Tommy also asks the defendant, do you have tickets for me? Some subsequent testimony or testimony during the course of trial by a law enforcement officer was to the effect that the word tickets in this context meant that Tommy was asking the defendant whether or not he had any money for him. There was a stash house that the defendant identified during the course of his cooperation with the government, which was subsequently terminated, and that stash house was searched. A consensual search of the stash house revealed a gun, money counting machines, and I believe a weighing machine as well, consistent with the idea that this was, in fact, a location where drugs were received and picked up. The defendant also went on to say that when he went to pick up drugs, there was also a regularized practice of how he'd pick up the drugs, that there would be two or three individuals there, that Tommy himself would not be present, and that that was the way they did business to avoid detection. So his confession is probably the most damaging piece of evidence, and as the Supreme Court said in Arizona versus Fulminante, you know, the confession is something that, you know, admission of which is almost never harmless error because it's so probative of the defendant's guilt. There is other evidence to back up what the defendant said, but I would believe it's the confession itself that is the most damaging piece of evidence. Turning to the merits as well, as to the three claims of error, the first one that receives a lot of attention in the defendant's briefing is the admission of Charles Bolden's statement that his source of supply was E. This is a case that is unlike a situation where admission of the statement is a damaging or damning piece of evidence. This isn't some sort of case where it's a mystery who the perpetrator of a crime is. What happens here, and it's useful to actually look at how the case unfolds, is that an officer is testifying, and during the course of testimony, indicates that the usual practice of the DEA when they make an apprehension is to try to work up the chain to find the source and to keep going up the chain in order to root out drug trafficking activity. And so the officer explains that Bolden is apprehended, and then efforts are made to actually locate Bolden's source of supply. And in the course of that colloquy, it's revealed that Bolden agrees to cooperate and that he agrees to call his source of supply E. Now, 5 pages after that occurs at about page 53 or 54 of the transcript. 5 pages after that, around page 59, there's a call between Bolden and Eberhardt. And during the course of that discussion of that call, you know, the officer is asked by counsel, well, could you identify the other voice on the call? Bolden places a call to somebody. Did you know who he placed that call to? At the time, he didn't. But after Eberhardt was arrested, the officer was able to say, well, the person on the other end of the call was Ivan Eberhardt. So you see, it wasn't exactly like the reference to E was some expose of some sort of information that was unknown to people. And when you add to the fact that after those calls occurred, that Ivan Eberhardt and Charles Bolden actually met at the KFC, and by the way, they didn't actually meet inside the KFC. They met outside of KFC, and you know, they didn't go into the KFC together and talk. They kept outside the KFC, and they went around in the car having a conversation. Not exactly a normal way of actually meeting a friend. But they did do that, and that...
Pardon me. You're into your rebuttal time, you know that.
Yes, I do. And I think that's indicative of the fact that it was no mystery that Charles Bolden had identified Ivan Eberhardt as his source of supply. I have nothing further to answer another question.
All right. Thank you, Matthew. Mr. Goodman.
May it please the Court, Your Honor. My name is Leonard Goodman, and I represent Ivan Eberhardt. First, I'd like to address the government's appeal and to defend Judge Zagel's grant of a new trial. And I'd like to hopefully spend a few minutes talking about the cross-appeal. First, on the issue of jurisdiction, the government has made jurisdiction the focus of their appeal, and there are several problems with the government's jurisdictional arguments. The first problem is that two out of the three errors which Judge Zagel relied upon to grant the new trial were timely raised. The government overlooks the fact that the Crawford error, that the out-of-court statements of Bolden, was timely raised. There was a contemporaneous trial objection, and that objection was renewed in the original new trial motion that was filed within 7 days. Yes, it was expanded upon later, but certainly the issue was raised. And those two issues, the issue of the Crawford error and the issue of the faulty transcript alone, were sufficient to justify the new trial, particularly in light of the Supreme Court's decision in Crawford, subsequent decision in Crawford. The second problem with the government's jurisdictional argument is the Contrick case, where the Supreme Court makes a clear distinction between jurisdictional rules and claim processing rules, and there is language in that opinion which suggests that the 7-day requirement...
So, but would you extend that to the 60-day limit for appeals or the 10 days in Civil Rule 59? Are you saying none of these time limits are jurisdictional anymore?
What I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is that there is language that suggests...
Well, yes and no. Do you think all time limits now are non-jurisdictional because of Contrick?
Judge, I guess what I would like to do...
I want you to answer my question.
I will answer the question.
Why don't you answer it now?
I don't know, to tell you the truth, Your Honor.
Okay,
I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's necessary to determine it in this case. And the reason...
I think it is. I mean, the government placed a lot of emphasis on the Brickwood case. And in the Brickwood case, which is a recent Fourth Circuit en banc decision, the court makes a distinction between post-trial, the timing of post-trial motion, and other types of deadline. It says the point, rules directed to determine the point in time when subject matter jurisdiction shifts from one court to another, those are jurisdictional. And if we follow that distinction, then the 7-day limit is jurisdictional.
I understand that. And there is language where Justice Ginsburg refers to her concurring opinion in Carlisle, which describes the 7-day requirement of Rule 29 as an example of a rigid time prescription which should not be classified under the heading subject matter jurisdiction. But the reason why I don't want to focus on that is because I believe that in this case it's a little bit different, because here, even if the government is correct, and even if what Your Honor is suggesting is correct, that these rules are jurisdictional because there is a transfer of subject matter jurisdiction from the district court to the appellate court. Here, the defendant did file a timely motion for new trial. So this case is different from Carlisle and from the United States versus Washington case of the Seventh Circuit. A timely motion was filed, and jurisdiction was retained by the district court. It was later supplemented, and the buyer-seller...
It's clear from Judge Daigle's opinion that that it was the cumulative effect of the three errors that convinced him to grant a new trial, and you're basically giving away one of them.
I'm saying that one of them was clearly untimely. The government made no contemporaneous objection, and Judge Daigle to rule on the merits and then object.
Yeah, that's true. But if it's jurisdictional, it doesn't matter. So then you're left with your two others.
Well, except, Your Honor, the only point that I was making is that even if the rule is jurisdictional, the fact is the district court retained jurisdiction. So then the question is, could he then accept? Did he have jurisdiction over all the issues, or did he only retain jurisdiction over two issues? And I would suggest that that is an open question, even if the time barrier is jurisdictional. Moving on to the merits of Judge Daigle's ruling, and the first error is the government's use of the out-of-court statements of Mr. Bolden.
But do you agree that Judge Daigle thought that it was the three errors together that argued for a new trial rather than two of the three?
Judge Daigle did say that, Your Honor, and what I would urge is I think that in light of Crawford, I think that Judge Daigle would have to revise his opinion about the seriousness of the government's use of Bolden's out-of-court statement. And I think that if there is a question as to what Judge Daigle would have done, then it should be remanded.
Isn't the evidence overwhelming, the evidence of Eberhardt's guilt?
My position is that, Your Honor, that this is about as weak.
Confession.
This is about as weak of a conspiracy case I've ever seen.
How do you explain away the confession? I don't understand.
Well, the confession, Your Honor, first of all, is given under. I've never heard of a conspiracy case that could be based solely on a confession, and that's basically what we have.
Confession has to be corroborated, but it is corroborated.
It really isn't, Your Honor. There's some after the fact tape recordings, which were a top cooperating informant is attempting to get Mr. Eberhardt to make admissions, and he doesn't. And I would urge the court to look at those tapes, look at those transcripts, and you'll see that they're almost completely useless. And there is there's out-of-court statements of Bolden. There really is no corroboration. There's no physical evidence. There's no drug seized.
Why isn't the stash house corroboration?
Well, but the stash house is related to the defendant's confession. And if
right,
you look at
but that's look, the standard corroboration would be the confession says something, and then you find out that's true. You find out that from external evidence that's true. So, that I mean, I said it's standard corroboration.
Well,
suppose someone who gives a confession and says, you know, there are drugs at 1222 East 56th Street, and then the police go there, no drugs, so there's no corroboration.
Well, first of all, if we look at the circumstances of the confession, this is not a bearing of the soul confession. This is a person who, during 3 days in police custody, is attempting to convince his captors that they should not treat him as a defendant, but that he can be useful to them in identifying someone else. So that's the nature of the discussions about Tommy, that the defendant was trying to convince these DEA agents that he could, in fact, lead them to someone else who was a drug dealer. There's no contemporaneous record of the confession. There's Agent Glynn admitted he took no notes. Agent Foley thought he took notes but misplaced them. The official report containing Mr. Eberhardt's statement is filed some 3 months later. The confession is in direct conflict with the evidence, of much of the evidence that was admitted at trial. For example, Eberhardt supposedly admitted doing a drug deal at a mall with Mr. Bolden at a time when 5 witnesses observed him at his home. The jury rejected that evidence. The jury certainly rejected at least part of his confession. His claim that he was had made arrangements to meet Tommy and purchase 10 kilos was shown to be false. There was no prior arrangement, and if you look at those tape transcripts between Mr. Eberhardt and Tommy, there is no prior arrangement, and certainly no drugs were ever obtained. Some of his claims in the confession are just incredible on their face. His claim that he earned $250 a kilo, a 1% markup, is a preposterous claim. And I would suggest that the evidence in this case is far weaker than other cases where this court has reversed. For example, United States versus Thomas. I've never seen a conspiracy case that is based where there's no physical evidence and there is no eyewitness, no person that comes to court to say, yes, I saw Mr. Eberhardt commit a crime, or I saw Mr. Eberhardt sell drugs or possess drugs. If I may return to the issue of the new trial, this case is a classic case under Crawford. What happened here is the DEA arrested a man named Mr. Bolden with 2 kilograms of cocaine. Bolden agrees to cooperate with the government and names Eberhardt as his supplier, but by the time the case comes to trial, Mr. Bolden could not keep his story straight and could not be used as a witness. The government decided, rather than put him on the stand and make him explain the 5 different versions, they would just put in his out-of-court statements through the DEA agents. And the government has minimized what went on at trial. This was not a single reference to E. This was pervasive use of his out-of-court statements. Agent Foley testified that Bolden identified his source of supply as E. Agent Glynn repeatedly referred to Bolden's cocaine source of supply as E. Agent Glynn also referred to a previous cocaine transaction between Bolden and E, for which Bolden was owed, which Bolden owed E $40,000. All of this testimony was based entirely on Charles Bolden's out-of-court statements. All of it was highly prejudicial. Bolden was an unreliable witness, and when it came in through the DEA lent credibility to those statements by making it sound as if it's part of their investigation and it's facts uncovered in their investigation. The court's limiting instruction was given only one time, when the first time this evidence was presented.
Would you agree it was a pretty thorough limiting instruction, Mr. Goodman?
I think it was a standard limiting instruction, but as the Supreme Court held in Bruton, an instruction to the jury not to consider an out-of-court statement for its truth, where that statement identifies the defendant on trial as the bad guy, is not an effective limiting instruction.
Well, who brought out, when did he become Eberhardt in the trial? Didn't that come from the defense counsel's examination?
it came from, well, as the government points out, the defense counsel made an objection in which he linked the name E and Eberhardt.
Right.
Certainly it was no secret. The government was about to play tapes between Mr. Bolden and E, and that's the defendant's voice on the tapes, and the agent was going to identify that voice as the voice of the defendant sitting at that table, Ivan Eberhardt. So I think that that's a red herring. The district court certainly did not abuse its discretion in relying on the out-of-court statements of Mr. Bolden or the faulty transcripts. The district court found that the use of a faulty transcript where the defendant had requested a face-to-face meeting with Mr. Bolden was troubling. The lower court found that these words matter because the jury was rightly told that face-to-face meetings are par for the course in criminal enterprises that fear wiretaps. And the district court also noted that both prosecutors emphasized this evidence in their respective closings. And the court concluded that a reasonable jury could find that these statements to be strong evidence of a drug conspiracy. In fact, the tapes themselves are, if you look at the transcripts of the tape-recorded conversations where Bolden is trying to get Mr. Eberhardt to admit to something, those tapes are so useless that the government had to rely on a statement which Eberhardt never made at trial to try to explain to the jury why there's nothing incriminating on those tapes. Well, according to the government, the reason there's nothing incriminating on the tapes is because Mr. Eberhardt was afraid of a wiretap and he wanted a face-to-face conversation, a statement which he never made. The final issue that the judge relied on was the absence of a buyer-seller instruction. The court found that, assuming that it was a timely issue and that he had jurisdiction to consider that, the lower court found that the jury should have had that defense in this case. This was a vague conspiracy. There was only one, and another problem with the conspiracy here is there was only one overt.
Back for a moment to this jurisdictional issue. You say you raised two of these three errors, but I only saw the one, the inaccuracy in the transcript, in your new trial motion.
Yes, the other error, the Bruton error, was objected to contemporaneously at trial.
I know.
And then there was an objection in the original new trial motion that said we renew. It was standard language, but it said
that
we.
I don't think it said that. I think it said all you said was the court erred by overruling defense objections and admitting improper evidence and argument to the jury.
That's correct.
So there was no actual reference to the specific objection.
That's correct. It said it renewed all objections made at trial and argued that that was an error.
Well, how can you have, the seven-day rule would mean nothing if you could file a one-line motion for a new trial which said, you know, there were errors, and in 6 months we'll submit a supplemental memo telling you what those errors were. That would completely defeat the seven-day rule.
You know, I guess
that's what you did with respect to all but the transcript. You did mention the transcript error, but you didn't mention anything else.
Well, actually, it was prior counsel that filed the original motion.
I'm not blaming you personally.
But Judge, my point would be that the court, that was sufficient for the court to retain jurisdiction.
No, it's not. It's not. Because, look, what you're saying is you can file a one-line motion for a new trial, and then 6 months later, you can file a supplement explaining what the errors are that you're complaining about. That completely defeats the seven-day deadline.
Well, it would come down to whether if it's a jurisdictional deadline, then perhaps you're
correct. If it's a jurisdictional deadline, of course, right.
And if
that's
if
the premise. That's what this Brickwood case holds.
But if
or says.
Right. But even so, that
then you're left with just the transcript error.
But
the judge made clear that, you know, you needed all three.
There's also a question as to whether, if the motion was timely filed, jurisdictional?
No, it wasn't timely because it wasn't timely as to two of the three issues.
Well, thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman. Mr. Blatchew?
One point on the main appeal with respect to the transcript, to the extent that's still live. The issue of face-to-face and whether or not that comment was prejudicial, it really wasn't at all. The reason that is that if one looks at the transcript, one sees that whatever Eberhardt said was followed by Bolden then saying, "I'll see you then." If one also looks at the transcript, it's clear from looking at the transcripts
that the both Bolden and Eberhardt are talking in code. There is clearly an effort to obfuscate, not mention things clearly, and there was testimony at trial that code is something that's often used by narcotics traffickers to shield them from detection. So I think in terms of understanding, was there this effort on the part of both parties to hide what they're doing and conceal what they're doing, it's clear from the record, not only from how they were talking on the tapes, but the fashion in which they met outside this KFC in somebody's car going around
what
the block.
What about Mr. Goodman's point that there are fantastic things in the confession, such as this $250, you know, 1%?
That isn't a large... I actually wondered about that. I thought at first that perhaps there was a mistake in the transcript of the possibility that maybe it's $2,500. Even if one looks at it, it's $250. Given the quantities that are being transacted, 20 to 40 kilos a month, it still works out to a fair amount of change at the end of the month. It's not a substantial amount, but it is a fair amount of money that could still be made at that type of markup. As to the cross appeal, it wasn't addressed during argument tonight. I don't know if the court has any questions relating to the jurisdiction of the cross appeal or not. If it doesn't, I'll be I'm done.
Thanks, Doctor. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.